Desert Island Discs. Each week, a well-known person is asked the question, if you were to be cast away alone on a desert island, which 8 gramophone records would you choose to have with you? As usual, the castaway is introduced by Roy Plumley.
Well, this week's castaway, ladies and gentlemen, retired recently after 37 years as a BBC announcer and newsreader, it's Alvar Liddell. Alvar, you've been listening to music for most of your working day for all those years. When you got home at night, did you play records?
Well, I got home, I just went to bed. I was too tired during the year.
You must have found it very, very hard to choose just 8 to last potentially for the rest of your life.
Oh, this was quite impossible, yes.
What were you looking for when you chose them? Records to evoke the past, to bring you great music, to give you uplift? What?
Great music. Also a reminder of 1 or 2 artists, where the artists matter more than the music in the choice.
What's the first one you have there?
Well, I've deliberately chosen something. I'm rather a sluggish getter-upper. So I've chosen a sparkling Viennese overture, Donna Diana by Reznicek.
Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, Donna Diana. What's your second record?
Chopin, next. Chopin I must have. Chopin, early love.
The Barcarolle.
Because it has with it such a glorious sense of euphoria, being caressed and rocked in the cradle of the deep. And I've chosen a particular recording, because I think it is supreme of this work, that of Dino Lipatti.
The opening of Chopin's Barcarolle in F-sharp major, played by Dino Lipatti. Alva, were you born in London?
Yes, Wimbledon Park, SW19.
You come from a Swedish family, don't you?
Yes, my father emigrated at the end of the last century and brought my mother over, settled in London as an agent for Swedish timber, and we children were brought up, and my mother decided we should have an English upbringing. So I'm what's called a second-generation Englishman. Yes.
You went to Oxford. What did you read?
Classics.
With a view to what?
Well, nothing of you, really, just to being educated at Oxford, I mean, which was the thing to do then.
What did you do when you came down?
I came down, bang, in the middle of the slump, or this is the beginning of the slump, 1930. The slump begun in 1929, hadn't it, in New York. And I didn't know what to do at all. I had, through the appointments board at Oxford, been lined up for a job with HMV, because the only thing I knew was that I wanted a job which had to do with music.
Yes.
And I hoped to get into HMV on their artistic side, but unfortunately they were actually not taking on new people. They were even firing some of their own people at that time, so that fell through.
Mm.
What did you do? I was qualified to teach, so I did a little what's now called supply teaching. I had vague aspirations about the stage and the films and even a bit of singing.
Yes.
I never got very far with the film extra parts because I was always too tall for the costume they had in mind.
So?
I also applied to the BBC for this reason, that in 1928, while I was at Oxford, the BBC had wanted somebody who could speak some Swedish authentically and who could speak English
with a Swedish accent. And I was expert.
As all we children were, from having heard a lot of broken Swedish when we were young. I was just the chap, 1928. Lars Sievking was producing a program about Sweden, and I was engaged for the job. Went up to Savoy Hill, and he put me in front of a microphone, gave me something to read, disappeared into the cubicle, came back literally in a flash, and said, okay, no problem, your voice is suitable for the microphone. So I did that job. And then 3 years later, 31, I remembered this and thought, well, I'm interested in music, my voice is okay for the mic, I can speak a bit, you know, I'd had a bit of acting at Oxford. I think this might add up to a BBC announcer, so I applied for an audition. I got an interview very soon, January 31, and was thought to be suitable and put on the waiting list. I then proceeded to wait, knocking about as before, a bit of teaching, etc. Forgot all about the BBC. Next thing that happened was that I met a man who was now a very distinguished BBC producer, Raymond Riggs, who had also been at Exeter College, Oxford, with me. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm out of a job. What are you doing? He said, oh, I'm just going on tour with an Italian marionette company as manager, and you're just the chap I'm looking for. I want somebody who can sing. And we're going to have to sing the prologue to Pagliacci live, and we then proceed to do it with marionettes to recorded music. And you're going to have to supply 10 minutes of songs to the orchestra with piano as an interlude. So off we went to the Theatre Royal Norwich for 1 week, and my share of the takings was 16 and sixpence. Then we moved on to New Brighton for a week, and that was slightly better. I think I got a quid or so that time. But then Raymond was taking the marionettes to Birmingham for Christmas week, and there were to be children's matinees, and he said, well, I think, actually, I'm sorry, I shall have to get a conjurer.
Pity, that would have been the good week, well into £2.
It might have been, yes, you never know. On the other hand, I think it was quite a good idea not to turn up in Birmingham as a sort of, you know, a second-rate singer, when a few weeks later, because I very soon now heard from the BBC that there was a vacancy as an announcer in Birmingham, which I took, February 32.
Yes. Was there a lot happening in Birmingham in those days, a lot of programmes originating in the Midlands?
No, the regions were really kept very short of money. They operated on a shoestring. They had to take what London put out mainly and just have a few odd programmes of their own. But, I mean, it covered the whole field, you know. There was music, serious music, light music, drama, variety, talks,
recitals. How long were you in Birmingham?
I was supposed to be there for 6 months, training. But obviously they must have forgotten all about me, because after about 15 months, still no word from London, I made a move myself and got a transfer.
Right.
And I came to London 18 months after joining. That would be September 33.
Let's break off at this point and have another record. What do we have?
I was brought up on the three B's, and in particular Beethoven. And there is one particular thing that I cannot do without, and that's the Eroica, the Third Symphony.
Opening of Beethoven's Third Symphony, Arturo Toscanini conducting the NBC Symphony Orchestra. What were the highlights in your pre-war career?
Well, one of the turning points in this difficult early stage was early 1934. I was reading the news on the night that the obituary of Elgar was included. And this must have been, it must have triggered off something that was right, because everybody agreed that this had been a very good bulletin. It was so important, I just fallen completely in love with the cello concerto, amongst others. And there was no room to be self-conscious. This mattered to me enormously, Elgar's death, and obviously I put over a good bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
So I always remember that. I remember also the abdication, later, 1936.
Yes.
When I happened to be the chap on duty one afternoon, was sent for and handed this momentous document which we were to broadcast at 3 o'clock after it had been proclaimed in the House of Commons.
You announced the outbreak of war, too, didn't you?
Yes. Yes, that was even more momentous. We were manning number 10 Downing Street and the war room round about September the 3rd in case of anything. You know, there might have been government announcements immediately on the outbreak of war to be read from the war room, as indeed they were. Something might have been happening at Downing Street. I happened to be there on that morning and knew already that there was going to be an important statement at 10 o'clock. I didn't know what kind. About a quarter to 10, Prime Minister's Secretary handed me this. And this was a communique giving the terms of this country's ultimatum to Germany, saying that it would expire at 11 o'clock and the Prime Minister would broadcast at 11:15. I then stayed on after doing that and announced Neville Chamberlain from the Cabinet Room and was the only person with him in the room while he made the terrible speech he had to make.
Yes. Was he communicative at all?
Oh, no. He was totally absorbed in this, to him, ghastly end to his efforts. He was a grief-stricken, despondent man.
Yes. You had a spell in the RAF. Then at the end of the war, third program?
Third program, yes. 1946 for 5 years.
Yes. And then, well, really, the voice of the Home Service.
Well, yes, 1951, I think it was, they set up again another specializing news-reading team, and I came back to Home Service.
Mm-hmm. Let's have record number four now. What shall we have?
Well, here's an example of a record I've chosen because of the artist. The singer, Kirsten Flagstaff. I think one of the most glorious singers ever. She made her reputation as a Wagnerian soprano, and it is a miracle that after years of that kind of weightlifting, she used to call it, her voice, the radiance, the gold of her voice survived unimpaired. I remember her for her song recitals more than her operatic triumphs. And I remember her in particular as an incomparable Grieg singer. Now, if ever on this island I was feeling lonely or unloved, I know exactly what antidote I should use, and it would be Flagstaff singing Ich liebe dich, or in the original Norwegian words for I love you, rather more beautiful than the hard German, Je elsker dig.
Kirsten Flagstaff singing Grieg's I Love You. Did you usually have time to rehearse a bulletin to yourself?
You always get a certain amount of time, but the nature of the BBC's news is last minute. They keep everything back as long as possible. Quite rightly. So as to be as up to the minute as possible. You have a quick look through. And in the war, very often you didn't see things. Now you mostly see things.
Mm. Very often not time to check pronunciations, for example.
That does happen, yes. But we're terribly well served, though. We have a whole pronunciation unit concerned with nothing else but that. Yeah. And they actually attend on us during the daytime bulletins. And in the evening, when they're not there, we've got the superb, unrivaled pronunciation index. I think there are something like 80,000 received pronunciations of names, people, mm-hmm. and places. So more often than not, you can find it.
And always the risk, of course, of a ridiculous typing error or an unspotted double meaning to give you the giggles.
Oh, you're right. Yes, indeed. We had once. Not me. And I don't think it actually went out, but it was printed as Gandhi is in goal again.
Now you've left the corporation, how do you feel about freelancing? I'm not going to talk about retirement, because I don't believe for a minute you're going to do that.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm going to fight like anything not to retire, you know, to keep working, because the nature of one's work here for so long has been at a sort of high pitch of nervous tension and alertness, you know, and if I didn't keep up this looking at the clock, I should, I'm sure, deteriorate rapidly.
Let's have some more music.
Now we come to, I referred to it earlier, Elgar. Yes, the cello concerto. This was recorded by a young cellist whom I regard as one of the world's most important musicians in any sphere, Jacqueline Dupré. Moreover, she had to conduct a cellist, John Wabirale. And between them and with the London Symphony Orchestra, they made what is to me an absolutely outstanding record. In fact, I find it difficult to believe that they had the vitality in recording conditions to produce this work, this marvel of sensitivity.
Opening of the Elgar Cello Concerto, Jacqueline Dupré with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Sir John Barbirolli. What's number six to be?
Here again, it's Fauré's Après un Rêve, but I've chosen it more for the sake of the artist and the music, although I love the song. The singer is Maggie Tate. Now, there's something about this singing, or this singer, perhaps I should say, which I can only call innocence. Or perhaps vulnerability. Anyway, I find it absolutely heartrending.
Après un Rêve, sung by dear Maggie Tate. Now, we've dumped you on this island, Alva. How well could you take to loneliness? Are you reasonably self-sufficient?
I think I'm fairly good at making do and mending, or at improvising. I'm not very practical. I can hear the family laughing like drains. you know, I can get hold of chunks of wood and put them together, like me.
Yes, what about the mental aspect?
I think I would be badly afflicted by loneliness, to tell you the truth.
Would you try to escape?
No, I'm frightened of the sea, too. I'm a terribly frightened person. Frightened of the microphone, too, really.
Record number seven.
Well, Schubert. I must have the double cello quintet, the C major. And if I were never rescued from my desert island, I would hope that with my last breath I would have the strength to get to the gramophone and put the needle down at the slow movement of this work and fade away. But I do also very much love the first movement for the sake of the two cello tune, one of the loveliest even Schubert ever thought of.
Thank you. An excerpt from the first movement of the Schubert Quintet in C major, the Amadeus Quartet, and William Pleath. Now we come to your last record. What's that to be?
Brahms. There is one piece of music that is quite indispensable. My wife and I both love it. In fact, it was after giving her a record of this way back over 30 years ago that on the same night I proposed and was accepted. So here, please let me have the Academic Festival Overture and conducted by the ideal Brahms conductor, recently 80, Sir Adrian Bolt.
Closing passage of the Academic Festival Overture by Brahms, Sir Adrian Bolt and the London Philharmonic Orchestra. There are your 8 records, Alvar. If you could only choose one of them, which would it be?
Well, it would have to be the Schubert, you see.
Second movement. The slow movement that you didn't play. That's it. And one luxury to take to the island with you?
Oh, yes, simple. 2 packs of playing cards, please. I adore bridge.
Bridge?
Yes.
How?
Playing bridge.
Oh, no,
I would simply arrange hands, you see, and bid them in an imaginary way. But you see, the thing with bridge, it's picking out the bridge hand cards, you see, because one day you're going to get 13 spades.
Yes.
All right, well, good luck.
And one book, assuming that you already have the Bible and Shakespeare.
Yes. Well, now, this is a matter of rationing, I suppose. I mean, I don't know how many volumes I can take. I know exactly what I want to take, but you may say it's too many. This is 16 volumes.
Is it one work?
Yes. The Oxford English Dictionary.
Oh, that's all right.
Oh, is it? Oh, good show.
Thank you, Alvar Liddell, for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it enormously.
Goodbye, everyone.